Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one and record your name when prompted. Today's conference is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to turn the conference over to your host, Christina Clafane. Thank you. You may begin.
Thanks, Giovanna. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for participating in today's call. My name is Christina Clafane, and I'm from the FDA's Office of Health and Constituent Affairs, and I will be moderating today. Thank you so much for attending to discuss the seventh and final major rule under the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act, the Intentional Adulteration Rule. Today I'm joined by Dr. Steven Ostroff, the incoming Deputy Commissioner for the Office of Foods and Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Susan Main, Director of FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, and Dr. Ryan Newkirk, Policy Analyst and FDA Lead for the rule. We will be taking your questions at the end of the call, but for now, let me turn it over to Dr. Ostroff to get us started.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for joining us either this afternoon or this morning, depending on where you're located. I would say that every week at FDA is atypical, but this one is especially atypical in that it's a week that contains several lasts, and as was mentioned, it's kind of a week of sevens. First, this is the last week that Mike Taylor will be serving as the Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine at FDA, and it's a post that he's held for the last 7 years. Second, as was just mentioned, we are releasing the seventh and the last of the major foundational rules for FSMA. And I think that there's a certain elegance in this symmetry of those two statements because Mike Taylor, more than anybody else, is so closely identified with FSMA. And I've often referred to him as Mr. FSMA. And after all, it was Mike that championed the need for the changes in FSMA. He was there when the law was being developed, when it was being passed by Congress, and when it was being signed into law by the President in 2011. And he has been a continuous presence throughout the process of developing and writing the implementing regulations. And so he was there while they were being developed, while they were proposed, and in four instances when they were reproposed, and now that they've been finalized. And he's also been the one that it has been the cheerleader that's been making the case that the impact of FSMA can only be realized if there is adequate funding to be able to implement FSMA in the way that it was designed in order to maximally reap the public health benefits that not only Congress but also the public expects. So I think that, without question, Mike will be leaving on a high note with the satisfaction of seeing the last of the major rules brought across the finish line on his last week at the agency. And this particular rule relates to prevention of intentional adulteration of the food supply, and you will be hearing more about the details of this rule by the next couple of speakers. But I think it's important to point out that you shouldn't think of the foundational FSMA rules as being seven standalone regulations because clearly they work together as a unit from farm to table in the same way that all of our various stakeholders, which have helped us so much in developing the regulations, have to work together to produce safe food. These rules are the basis for building a new food safety system that's focused on preventing problems up front rather than waiting for outbreaks or illnesses to occur. And they will also work to strengthen what is becoming an increasingly global and complex food system and will guarantee the equivalent safety levels of food, whether it's produced within or outside of the United States. They will only succeed based on high levels of compliance on the part of regulated industries. Partnerships were crucial to the success of the rulemaking, and they will be even more crucial during implementation. And as we stated before, we are fully committed to providing the technical assistance, the training, and the guidance that's necessary to assure our partners in implementing FSMA that they know what to expect and how to do it. So please take advantage of those implementation tools, and please provide feedback to us in terms of what's working well and what may not be working as well as anticipated as we go forward. I will say that getting to this point where we are issuing the final rule took a tremendous amount of work, but it's also important to point out that this doesn't get us to the finish line. It gets us to the starting line, because that's exactly where we now are as we will move into the implementation phase of the 7 foundational rules. Before I turn it over to Dr. Main, I think that I would be remiss if I didn't thank, in addition to Mike Taylor, all of the other people at FDA that have worked so hard over the last few years to put these rules in place and to produce them. This hard work, without question, fundamentally changes the food safety paradigm in the United States and in many other parts of the world. And it clearly changes that paradigm for the better. And I think that that's the ultimate reward. I would also like to thank all of you who are on the phone, who are our stakeholders, for sticking with us and for your input throughout the process and your commitment to implementing these rules in a very effective way. So with that, what I'm going to do is turn it over to Dr. Susan Main, who is the director of our Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition.
Thank you, Steve. As Dr. Ostroff mentioned, the rule released today is the 7th and final major rule under FDA's Food Safety Modernization Act, which is aimed at preventing food safety problems throughout the food supply chain. Let me be clear what we mean by intentional adulteration. In the context of this rule, it means deliberate contamination of foods by those who want to hurt many people. That said, an event in which the food supply is adulterated with the goal to cause wide public health harm, including acts of terrorism, is unlikely. However, in the event that it occurs, intentional adulteration could have devastating consequences for public health. Such an event may also result in widespread public fear, loss of public confidence in the safety of the food, and the ability of government to ensure food safety, and significant adverse economic impacts, including disruption of trade. That's why today's final rule is focused on the steps companies need to take in order to prevent intentional adulteration of the food supply. In order to protect food from such destructive acts, there needs to be a shift in approach from the safety standards established in the other FSMA rules. Rather than targeting specific foods or hazards, this rule requires mitigation of risk-reducing strategies or risk-reducing strategies for processes in registered food facilities that are most vulnerable to an intentional contamination event that could hurt a lot of people. We've established that the highest risk of intentional adulteration is from an inside attacker. This conclusion is based on FDA's interactions with the intelligence community and vulnerability assessments conducted in collaboration with the food industry. The requirements of the final rule take this into consideration. Under the new rule, food facilities, for the first time, are required to complete and maintain a written food defense plan that assesses their vulnerability to intentional adulteration, where the intent is to cause wide-scale public health harm. The plan also requires facilities to identify and implement mitigation strategies to address these vulnerabilities. They will need to establish food defense monitoring procedures and corrective actions and verify that the food defense system is working. The final rule also includes requirements related to training as well as requirements for records. FDA proposed the intentional adulteration rule in December of 2013. The changes in the final rule are largely designed to provide either more information where stakeholders requested it, or greater flexibility for food facilities in determining how they will assess their vulnerabilities, implement mitigation strategies, and ensure that the mitigation strategies are working as intended. Prior to developing this rule, we have worked with others for a number of years to protect the food supply under a voluntary program. FDA partnered with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Department of Homeland Security, and other federal, state, and local government and industry partners to assess the vulnerability of the U.S. food supply and to identify strategies to reduce these vulnerabilities. We have incorporated that experience and knowledge into key requirements of this final rule. The final rule also takes into consideration more than 200 comments submitted to the docket. The FDA included a number of exemptions, most notably based on business size. Since this rule is designed to reduce or prevent acts intended to cause wide-scale public health harm, the requirements apply to larger companies whose products reach many people and where intentional adulteration would have a larger impact. The final rule does not cover activities of farms, although further considerations will be given to the possibility of requiring mitigation strategies to restrict access to milk on dairy farms in a way that is appropriate and practical to require. The FDA will continue to work with key partners to protect the food supply. For activities on dairy farms in particular, the FDA will be working with the National Conference on Interstate Milk Shipments, a federal-state collaborative program for milk safety, along with other stakeholders in developing strategies to protect milk from intentional adulteration. We recognize that food defense may be new to many in industry, and additional time may be needed to learn about intentional adulteration and the requirements of this rule. Therefore, in the final rule, we have extended compliance dates by an additional 2 years for each business size. The largest businesses will need to comply in 2019. With regard to implementation, FDA is committed to working with both industry and our government and international partners to ensure effective implementation of FSMA's new food safety and food defense laws. Implementation of the intentional adulteration rule and all FSMA final rules will absolutely require partnership, education, and training. The FDA and others are working on valuable tools to make compliance with the final rules easier, such as training courses and our technical assistance call center. So that briefly sums up this new final rule, and I'm going to turn the call back over to Christina.
Thank you to all our speakers. Now I'd like to ask the operator to open the phone lines and provide instructions for our callers on how to ask a question. Just a reminder to please state your name and the name of the organization prior to asking your question. Operator?
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one. Be sure your line is unmuted and record your name when prompted. If you wish to withdraw your question, please press star two. Again, to ask a question, please press star one. One moment while we wait for questions to queue.
While we're standing by for questions, I'd like to note that we will be hosting a webinar covering this topic on June 21st at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. To hear the presentation, you can dial into 888-946-6302, and the passcode would be 3811136. To find out more about this webinar, please visit www.fda.gov/FSMA. Operator, we'll take our first question.
The first question comes from Eric Lieberman. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Eric Lieberman of U.S. Food Imports, LLC. I had a question. The proposed rule makes a distinction between acts of terrorism and acts of disgruntled employees, and I'm looking at the final rule, and it looks like we really don't have that distinction anymore. The final rule basically requires facilities to focus on preventing attacks that could cause wide-scale public harm, whether or not they're from terrorists or disgruntled employees. I'm wondering if you can discuss that further, the difference between the proposed and final in terms of how the rule approaches disgruntled employees. Thank you.
Sure, Eric, that's a great question. This is Ryan Newkirk with FDA's Food Defense Team. You are correct. In the proposed rule, we did differentiate acts of terrorism, acts of disgruntled employees, consumers, and competitors, and also economically motivated adulteration. Economically motivated adulteration is considered and is required. Those considerations are required in the PC rules. As you also noted, the final rule includes consideration and preventive measures for acts intended to cause wide-scale public health harm. When we were going through comments for the final rule, there was a little bit of confusion and potential overlap between disgruntled employees and terrorism. We still continue to believe, and the statute directs us to do so, to cover those point steps or procedures in the food supply chain that are at highest risk of intentional adulteration. In considering the spectrum of risk for intentional adulteration, it was those acts intended to cause wide-scale public health harm. Mostly those acts could be considered a terrorism attack on the food supply, but if a disgruntled employee, consumer, or competitor changes their motivation and wants to cause an act of wide-scale public health harm, the requirements of the rule would also significantly minimize or prevent those acts. And furthermore, we do intend to publish guidance on this matter that addresses more specific details for the topic.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for your question. Did you have any follow-up to that?
I think that that pretty much addresses it. I mean, basically, it's the focus is on wide-scale public harm, regardless of whether or not an employee or a disgruntled employee is involved in a terrorist network. I mean, if someone wants to hurt lots of people, that's even if they're acting alone, that's something that this that needs to be contemplated in accordance with this regulation.
Absolutely, Eric. Yes.
Right. Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, we'll take the next question. And please remember to state your name and the name of your organization prior to asking your question.
The next question comes from, I believe, Akana Patil. Your line is open. Akana, please check your mute button. Your line is open.
Yeah. So the rule demands that the people assigned to vulnerable areas receive appropriate training. So I want to understand what is appropriate training, and similar to the preventive control rules where we have the clear understanding about the preventive control qualified individuals, is there something for this rule also?
Yes, thank you for your question. So we very strongly feel, and this was something that was also coming out of the public comments from almost everyone, that training is a key part for an adequate food defense posture for facilities covered by the rule. Appropriate training, we will designate a number of different areas that are required training, both in food defense awareness, so what is food defense, why is it important, as well as certain areas for writing and creating the food defense plan. Some of those areas include how to conduct a vulnerability assessment, as well as what needs to happen when you're reanalyzing the food defense plan. We do have a definition of qualified individuals. The gist of that definition is that individuals need to be qualified through a number of different ways, either training, education, experience, or a combination thereof.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Operator, do we have any other questions?
The next question comes from Curtis Anderson. Your line is open.
Yes, this is Curtis Anderson of Seymour Milling. We are in the flour milling industry, specifically wheat flour, but my reference to or my question is in reference to the exception of farms and indeed the except for the dairy farms and dairy industry. Is there any thought of application of that type of philosophy to other commodities like the wheat farms, the flour industry, including other grains, those types of products, if you will, or commodities in respect to the widespread effect that they could have?
Sure. Thank you, Curtis. Again, this is Ryan Newkirk with the Food Defense Team. We have, through our years of working with industry, identified that there are certain processes, steps, or procedures that drive vulnerability. For those, they occur for the wide-scale public health harm will occur in manufacturing and processing settings. For those facilities that are required to register with FDA through Section 415 of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, those are the facilities that are required then to comply with this rule if they don't fall under an exemption. The exemption does apply to activities occurring on produce farms, and to just clarify just the note, there are no requirements for dairy farms either.
Did you have a follow-up to that, Mr. Anderson?
No, very good. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Operator, do we have any other questions?
Currently, there are no questions in queue. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one.
Okay, and while we wait for the next question, I'll just remind you that the webinar to discuss this rule more thoroughly will be on June 21st, and we're working to schedule more webinars and meetings around the country to meet with our stakeholders on this rule. We look forward to discussing this implementation with you.
Okay, we do have some questions in queue. The next question comes from Jason Bashura. Your line is open.
Hey, Ryan. Thanks for your work with this. Really excited to get through the rule. Still reading it, although we just got the heads up on the call about a couple hours ago, so I haven't gotten through the whole thing. Response 105 talks about the establishment of the intentional adulteration subcommittee within the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance, but it doesn't identify industry stakeholders. It talks about industry associations. So are you seeking or will there be input available from actual industry owners, operators, or just those associations? Thank you.
Thank you, Jason, for that question. It's good to be speaking with you. We have just recently, and we are very excited to be able to share this, have stood up the Intentional Adulteration Subcommittee within the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance. Part of that standing up of the committee is initial activities of funding the committee and establishing ground rules and also looking for committee members. So those particular activities, some are underway, some are not. I believe the focus is on associations. But if you could please submit your question through the Technical Assistance Network, we will also be able to get you details about that.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Operator, we'll take the next question.
Carlos Cortez, your line is open.
Good afternoon, everybody. Carlos Cortez with Mondelez International. My question comes through if the FDA will recognize any of the international standards that are currently established that have some multinationals have potentially been using already, including the direction on many of the mitigations that are in effect based on the rule. And that's a two-sided question. Also, the outreach of the audit on international locations when it comes to food defense. What is the plan to work outside of the U.S. and Canada when it comes to the audit piece? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Carlos. To take your first question about recognizing international standards, we do recognize that there are great work being conducted and being done through these some of these international standards that include particular details on food defense. We did receive a number of comments asking your exact question. I can tell you that we can't recognize these standards as 100% equivalent and compliance with the rule. But what I can tell you is that we do feel that a number of these standards include activities that will reduce vulnerability of such entities to intentional adulteration. Also related to this, in the final rule, we have included in the regulatory text the allowance for existing records. So there could be the potential, and this needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis, that records that these facilities are using under these international standards could have components that do require that do comply with the rule. I believe that answers your first question. Your second question, could I ask you to repeat it, please?
Yeah, it was based on the for multinationals that have already engaged in food defense programs, how is going to be the outreach of the FDA in regards of the audits or reviews that will be performed outside of U.S. ground?
Sure. So I can take the outreach piece first. We do have robust plans in place to conduct education, training, and outreach for both the domestic and the international audience. Some of your questions, I also believe, could be asking about inspection, and we are currently working through the best approach for inspection at this time, and we will share that with you once it's finalized.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the next question.
Clay Detlefson, your line is open.
Thank you. Clay Detlefson, National Milk Producers Federation. Dr. Newkirk, others, thank you for promulgating what was, I'm sure, a very difficult rule to issue. Generally, I think things look good. I appreciate the dairy farm process that you're going to engage with the MCIMS. I think that's a good solution to that issue. One question I have is with respect to vulnerability assessment requirements, certain segments of the food industry, namely dairy, have taken a very hard look at our vulnerabilities over the years. We've done many vulnerability assessments. Will dairy facilities be required to go back through that once again, or can we rely on our past efforts in that area? Thank you.
Clay, thank you. This is Ryan again. Excellent question. So a little bit of the response to the last question I think is appropriate here as well. In the proposed rule, we did not have consideration of the use of existing records. In the final rule, there is allowance for use of existing records. However, specifically related to vulnerability assessments, from the proposed to final, there are new details that need to be considered at a minimum for an appropriate method to conduct a vulnerability assessment. So I would encourage dairy facilities to read through those particular details, look at their existing records, and see if they need to update those in any way.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Operator, do we have any other questions?
There are no questions in queue at this time.
Okay, well, we give folks a second to reminder to hit star one if you have a question. I'll go ahead and remind you that in your invite today, we did link to the Federal Register notice with the rule, the constituent update, and the fact sheet regarding this rule. So if you need those links, go ahead and check the invite that was sent out this morning. We'll take the next question.
Thank you. The next question comes from Warren Stone. Your line is open.
Hello. This is Warren Stone from the Grocery Manufacturers Association. I echo Clay's sentiments. Thank you for promulgating this. I'm sure it was lots of work, and it's a groundbreaking rule for the entire food safety community. My question was on warehousing. I noticed the applicability portion of the rule says that it applies to owner-operators, et cetera, that manufacture, process, pack, or holds food. But then under the portion in 121.5B exemptions, it says it does not apply to holding food except liquid storage. Could you clarify that, please? Are warehouses covered?
Sure, Warren. Thank you for your question. You are correct in reading your read of the exemption of holding of food is exempt except for holding of food in liquid storage tanks. So if a warehouse is only holding food and not doing any other manufacturing or processing activities, those warehouses are exempt.
Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stone. Operator, we'll take the next question.
Eric Lieberman, your line is open.
Will the agency hold a public meeting on this rule as they have for the other FSMA rules? I think that would be great if they decide to do so. Hello?
Thank you for your question. Currently, at this time, we don't have plans to hold a public meeting. But if you would like to submit your comments to us, we'll definitely take that into consideration.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, do we have any other questions?
There are no questions in queue at this time. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one.
I believe we have time for about one more question. We'll give it a moment. Just as a reminder, the webinar regarding this rule will be Tuesday, June 21st at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Do we have any more questions?
There are no questions at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for attending today. And this will conclude our stakeholder call. Have a great day.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. Participants, you may disconnect at this time.